Welcome to the Mother Forkin' Podcast. Where we feed you some real shit on parenting.
We are here today, Celeste and I, on the Mother Forkin' Podcast, and it has been a minute. Actually, it's been several months. So we are excited to come back after a much needed break for personal reasons, which we will dive into a little bit later. But today we have Jordan Claire McCraw. She was raised outside of Washington, D.C. and was a 2008 graduate of the Gemstone Honors Program at the University of Maryland. She received her bachelor's degrees in theater performance and English, creative writing for poetry, which is actually what we're going to be talking with her about today. So 1 week after graduating, Jordan moved to the UK to live with her now husband, whom she had met actually while volunteering in West Africa. That's really cool. Jordan worked as a high school teacher in England until 2015, and then she had her son, where she struggled with postpartum depression, which we know all too well about. And that inspired her to return to her love of acting, becoming a voiceover actress for clients in London, such as Mattel. Jordan is now a television, film, and commercial actress based out of New York City, and she reached the top 16 in the 2019 Maxim CoverGirl competition as a woman's mental health advocate, which is really cool. She is a proud audiobook narrator for HarperCollins and the Library of Congress. Wow, that's really awesome. So Jordan, I actually have a couple of things in common with you. Not only am I a mother who struggled with postpartum depression, and I even feel like I'm still probably struggling with that years later, but I competed in a Maxim competition too. It wasn't the CoverGirl competition though. That one sounds a little bit more awesome, but it was the Hometown Hutties. I don't know if you ever remember that.
Yes. Yes. Oh my God. That's so funny.
Yeah. So, but that was back in like 2007. That was so long ago. So.
Oh, but you're still a Hometown Hottie.
I mean, you know, I try.
these things never expire.
This is right. You are right. Yes.
And we age like wine. So
Yep.
No totally. One would stand a chance now.
No, come on. Definitely not.
Yeah. Personally,
we got to get Celeste on this too.
I know.
I'm so excited to have you, Jordan, to have Megan, to have a conversation, to hear all these things, even though I'm not a summer bod ready yet.
We'll get you there.
That is we'll get you entered. You guys have both done that.
Girl, summer bod is a state of mind.
Exactly. That's true. That's true.
But that might be why none of us are there. I don't know. Like a year into the pandemic, I'm just like, am I still inhabiting my body? Like, am I here at all? I don't know. It's a little dissociative.
Yeah. It's definitely been a mind fuck. But Jordan, I am an avid reader and I like my books in excellent shape. I hate cracking the spine, folding back the cover, or dog earing any pages. I cringe when I see this happening. However, I made an exception with your book, American Rapture. I ended up dog earing almost all of the pages.
Yes.
And I hope you don't mind, but I did this because as a woman, as a mother, as a wife, as a daughter and a friend, even as an employee, I felt your book so hard. I went through so many emotions, laughing, crying, or tearing up, having chills, and then literally saying fuck yes out loud. So what you've created with American Rapture and published is definitely what we women need. So I want to have you tell us more about how this book was born. Again, to let the audience know, it is a book of poems, a collection of poems. So have you always written poetry, and what made you create this masterpiece?
Well, first, guys, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here with like minds. And hearing that my work created that range of emotions in you and that response in you means everything to me. And it's awesome, you know, because I'm so glad that what I needed, which was to write this book, has resulted in the creation of something that now other women feel like they need too, which just feels so lucky, you know, because when I was writing it, I felt very alone, actually. And I was imagining that community. I was imagining that community of women that for me at the time just did not exist. And I was talking to them in my head and almost performing this work to an empty auditorium in my head and imagining the seats filled with other women who needed to hear what I had to say. But it was all conceptual. So the thought that my work is out in the world now and is, and that other women are connecting with it just makes me so happy. It not only gives the work an audience, but it gives me a family, you know? So I'm really thrilled to hear that. In terms of me and how the work came to be, I wrote my way back to health, basically. So I was hospitalized for a postpartum nervous breakdown in March 2019, which was actually 2 years ago last week, I think. So it's really cool to think that 2 years after that, I'm sitting here talking to you. You know, life is pretty crazy. And when I was hospitalized, actually, the way my nervous breakdown manifested, and it is kind of funny, actually, right? Like mental health crises, it's funny. Like it's ridiculous. But I just went silent. And that's how actually the people around me who love me knew that I was sick, because I never shut up. Like I just don't stop talking. And when I was hospitalized, I was basically in a dissociative state. I had experienced so much trauma and grief that I just shut down. And I think I had been living in fight or flight for too long. And my body kind of just, I don't know. It was like I just entered this state where I could no longer engage. And it was probably some primitive self-protection, you know? And so when I was hospitalized, I had lost my voice. And the way I got healthy, if we can use that word, I'd like to think I'm healthy now. The way I healed myself was I had to find my voice. It was like this crazy labyrinth inside my head. I was tracking her down. Like, where is she? And because that's my best friend, and that person will take me out of this. And my voice started returning to me in sort of snapshots, like almost like Polaroids. Like I would be sitting there kind of empty, and then I would have a quick visual or a quick stanza, or almost like the length of a text message thought returned to me, and I would write it down. And what was so fascinating about that moment in time is it's like I not only had my voice returning to me in snapshots, but each of those snapshots was a part of me processing the trauma that had gotten me to that place. And so the book literally is structured in the structure of a mind reassembling.
I love that. Did you know when you were jotting down these thoughts, these stanzas, these, as you said, text messages coming back to you, that it was going to be a book? Or were you just like, this is kind of me journaling at the moment, or to kind of bring you back to health, so to speak?
Yeah. You know, at first I didn't know. At first it was literally me trying to reconnect with myself and just documenting the moments in my day that I could understand. And sort of trying to construct an image of myself that I could point to and say, aha, there she is. That's me. I was starting from scratch, basically. And there's a poem about this in the book about being burned to the ground, but that's really what it was like. I was, you know, not to be, you know, cheesy and use an analogy here, but if we're all a forest, right? This was the point in time in which my forest was regenerating, and the seeds were underground, and I had no idea what I was going to look like once I grew back. I didn't know who I was. So it was a process of me reconnecting with myself. But then, you know, what's really interesting is I got, I don't know, I would say like 60 poems in, and I was bedridden at the time. You throw Jordan in the fire, and the two things she is at her core are a storyteller and an overachiever. So I was like, I've always been such a student, you know, I'm always like living for the next goal. So I thought, I'm telling this story to an empty room inside my head. I don't want that room to be empty. This is going to be my book. Like, I'm bedridden. I've always wanted to write my book. I've never been able to set time aside in my life to write my book. And I might as well make use of being in this like borderline vegetative state and just sit here and do the thing. And, you know, I obviously started writing the book while bedridden, and then I had to get back to my life. And I was working as an actor, commuting back and forth to New York City. And I wrote a lot of the book on the Greyhound bus. I wrote a lot of the book sitting in parking lots waiting for a Greyhound bus. I wrote the book in these actually really dark, miserable places that I was having to inhabit to move my life forward, because that was how I kept myself remembering that my life was moving forward. It's like, I'm not just sitting in this parking garage for nothing. I'm working toward my future. And while I wait for this bus to come so that I can get to my audition, I'm going to work on my book, you know? So it was how I kept my head above water until I could heal. I needed to feel that I was moving toward.
Lost here real quick. I wanted to say that I absolutely love that you chose to write it in the form of poetry. I don't know if you mentioned if you had experience writing it in poetry, but exactly what you were saying about the snapshots is what I as a reader experienced. Like, I was feeling your pain. And by the end of the book, it was like watching you just develop into this, you know, badass, beautiful version of yourself. So
thank you.
You chose poetry.
I'm glad that that came through in the form. You know, because that was another thing, is like, not only was I finding my voice as a person, but thinking, how do I communicate that on the page? And, you know, in terms of how I format the work and the length of the work, I'm really glad that translated. And part of my process was finding not only my own voice as a person, but how to translate that to the page. And actually, one of the things I did in the book, and these are sort of the small choices that you hope are so organic that people don't even notice them. But I made choices like, at the start of the line, there is capitalization and punctuation. And by the end of the line, that has deteriorated. And so that choice in particular was a reflection of the fact that these thoughts would come to me and almost run away. And I was like chasing them, you know, and trying to get to a pencil before it left. So little things like that in the poetry itself were, I was trying to capture the chaos that was generating the art in the first place.
Definitely. And I have to admit that like choosing which poem I absolutely loved was pretty hard, because I feel like with poetry, every time you revisit a poem, it's almost like you experience this different personal moment in your mind than you read it the first time. Does that make sense? And I think that's why I also love poetry, because it's kind of like so complex in a way.
Yeah. And yet a lot of people hate poetry, because a lot of poetry, and this is just my opinion, because I studied poetry and I taught English for 10 years. So I feel entitled to say that a lot of poetry is certified bullshit because it's because a lot of poetry is condescending. And then the flip side of that, I would argue that a lot of Insta poets, for example, and like our generation's use of poetry with social media, actually we don't ask enough of it. And I'm not going to call out any names, but like, I feel like there has to be a happy medium between condescending to people and just being vapid. And the thought that poetry can be accessible. And, you know, when I was first writing these poems, I thought, you know, I have a lot of colleagues in academia, particularly in Britain, who are probably going to look at these poems and think, what the fuck is that? Like, that's you know, that is a pretty simple statement turned into word art. And I would argue, as a storyteller, as an artist, as somebody with a background in education and, you know, literacy outreach, I would argue that what excites me about writing poetry and what excites me about the form is including people in a feeling, you know, making a feeling a safe space. You know, we're in a society that is very afraid of feeling and even of communing. And, you know, we're in a very fragmented time as well, in isolation and everything else. And the thought that a poem can literally be word art, that you're sort of composing with language to create a sensation that people can share and that makes them feel understood, that when they feel that feeling that someone else is having, they think, oh, I have that feeling too. That makes that feeling okay. That's human. That's not me being flawed. Exactly. You know,
that you say that it's human. One of my favorites that just kind of stood out with me was your rebirth announcement. I don't know if I'm able to read that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So you wrote, maybe now she's free to present not as a whole, but in pieces, rebirth announcement. And so I love that because to me, in a sense, it's spiritual. And as a mother, I feel like we experience this transformation, this new version of ourselves. And it's not until then where we're able to see that, you know, it's not this perfect idea or picture of motherhood. And so right. When we accept that, I feel like that's when we are free. We are free to be in the present. We are free to just experience it, you know, for what it is, if that makes any sense. So
thank you. And I, you know, I would agree that I think actually I feel gaslit by the world in that, you know, there is this narrative that women become obsolete after we've gotten married or after we've had children or once we're middle age. Yes. And like, it's even trite at this point to make the very obvious connection to the patriarchy, right? Like this age old idea that we are of peak value in adolescence and in a virginal state, and that women's worth proportionally deteriorates with time. But I feel gaslit because I look at the women around me and I genuinely, objectively, not defensively, think that they get more beautiful with age. We all do. We're a very wise demographic, and wisdom becomes us, and the brokenness and the healing and the scars and all of those things, that is what wisdom comes from. You know, wisdom doesn't just happen in a vacuum. And the deeper a woman's soul in her eyes, the more you have to look at. Like, I can't even conceive of how anyone would think differently about that. But it took a lot for me to overcome those patriarchal notions and to accept that this was happening to me, that I was aging, that I was breaking and reassembling. And I had to step outside of the prejudice that I grew up around and come to that conclusion for myself. And then I just want to shout it from the rooftops because I feel like all women need to hear it. And also, you know, there is this idea that value is attached to perfection. I don't know if it's because we were raised by boomers, right? Mm-hmm. We don't want to call out the boomers, like, not that they are aware of the problems they've caused, but that notion is obsolete. And actually what makes people interesting is the shit about them that is wacky and different. You know, I was doing stand-up in New York City shortly after I was discharged from the hospital 2 years ago. And that, just as an example, that's something that would normally be really scary, right? Like doing stand-up comedy in Times Square, like vomit. But it was awesome. I have never enjoyed my job so much because I had nothing left to lose, you know, and people were laughing because I had already committed the cardinal sin of being chucked in a psych ward. Like, it doesn't get much more embarrassing than that. And I was free. I was finally free to say things that other people are too afraid to say. And somebody needs to say this stuff. And because of that, I finally felt like I had something to say. Once I had broken and it was out there, suddenly I was of value and I had something to contribute.
And when you, so talking about this, I feel like this is a perfect segue into something that I wanted to mention. So about one of the poems that I particularly love, and I think this is a perfect time for us to even change that narrative too, you know, of, oh, younger and being, you know, youthful and everything is better. And, but you're right, as you, and I agree, as you get older, we are actually, we're wiser. I feel like you're right. We are more beautiful. And maybe not just on the outward appearance, but also inward. But there's this one particular poem called Stronger Sex. It says, mm-hmm. Never say sorry to a fucking guy for my postpartum tits. Tits should have a story. What is his story? So I love this one and totally resonated with me because postpartum, I've struggled so much to even like my body, even a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hate being naked and I hate, especially if my husband sees me naked, I just automatically think he's thinking, damn, what the fuck happened to her body? But maybe I think that because that's what I think of my body. I had my youngest about 3 years ago and I still struggle with what my stomach looks like because my stomach's never looked like that. Same thing with what my boobs look like, even what my vagina looks like. So in a way I feel like I'm saying sorry to my husband for my body not looking like it once used to. And I just can't wait to be in that place where I'm like, you know what? I'm owning it. Yes. This is my beautiful body that birthed two healthy babies. Say something.
Well, you know, I don't think I'm there. You know, it's a constant work in progress, isn't it? And again, we are going up against all the messaging we've been fed our entire lives here. Mm-hmm. And we're really the first, you know, every generation of women before us has had their own mountain to climb. And this is kind of our mountain. Like now we are deconstructing the generations before us were deconstructing actual like legal obstacles. And our big deconstruction as a generation is the subtler, insidious messaging that, you know, might have gotten missed by earlier generations because they were in a more acute state of crisis. And overcoming that messaging requires a rewiring that is a constant dialogue with oneself. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm working on it all the time. And I think all we can do is be aware and call ourselves out compassionately and lovingly. But, you know, like when I wrote this poem, I was actually dating outside my marriage at the time. And that's something we can talk about in a little bit. But my husband and I, we needed a pause to grow separately. We were at a point where our journeys sort of diverged. And my husband and I suddenly realized, you know, that my husband knew the story of my body in a way that these other guys did not, and that they could never appreciate, right? Mm-hmm. Like he had watched me give birth. He had watched me be cut open and shoddily stitched back together. Like he knew all of it. And these other guys didn't, particularly the ones without children, right. You know, and it was after I wrote this poem, after being with one guy and, you know, I literally apologized to him. I said, I'm so sorry. And I was hiding my body. And afterward, you know, he was just a dude. Like he had never given birth. He had never nourished a child. Mm-hmm. I just slapped myself after. And you just hid your supernaturally powerful body from some joker who has never been through, like he cannot even conceive of what your body has survived. And, you know, he should be so fucking lucky. And I can intellectualize that. And I think I've gotten to the point where by calling myself out and being my own mentor and reparenting myself and trying to rewire my thinking, I can intellectualize it. And I think internalizing it is a process of leading with compassion that just takes a lot of practice and a lot of work. And, you know, I think one of my gestures toward loving myself is standing up in front of the world and saying, I haven't treated myself right. Like, it's like the ultimate apology. It's like I'm standing outside my own window with a boombox, you know? Like, I'm sorry. I love you.
I just want to say throughout, you know, because you mentioned that this process was your form of healing. Did you experience, I mean, it must have been very demanding and challenging for you. At some point, did you experience like where you just kind of wanted to give a break or give up in this writing process? Because this year is the first year that I actually found and sought out help from a therapist. And it's been
the best. Well done.
Yeah, it's been the best thing for me. Anyone listening knows that, like, I was like, oh, I haven't seen a therapist, and Megan's been very open about it. And so when I finally did it, I was like, man, this is what I needed in my entire life. Like, what the heck?
Yes.
But I feel like at the end of those sessions and you know, processing it, it's a lot. So I can't imagine you going through it and writing an entire book and just like, you know, healing. Like, how was that for you?
Well, you know, first of all, congrats for therapy. Like, I wish everyone could have it. Mm-hmm. Government subsidized, particularly now. It's just, yep. It's about learning roadmaps for existence. You know what I mean? And no one is above needing that. So I'm really happy for you that you've got that resource now. I think that actually, you know, I had done about 10 years of therapy before my nervous breakdown. And I think that's a common misconception, you know, is that that happens to people who haven't gotten help. I was very privileged to receive a lot of help. And actually, I feel like it was after 10 years of therapy that I finally realized what the fuck was wrong. And it was too much. And I didn't know how to fix it. So it was almost like my soul left my body while I was still alive. And so what was overwhelming was the story itself. I think that the writing process was actually a place of refuge. And I would go, you know, 3 or 4 days without writing anything, and not a thought would come to me. And, you know, I was going through the motions of motherhood, but I had no internal narrative. And then all of a sudden on day 4 or day 5, I would get 7 poems, you know, while unloading the dishwasher. I would just get like, fum, 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 and I was like, ah, and I would run and I would put my son in front of, you know, Paw Patrol and frantically try to jot it down before I lost them. And so I think part of it too is like, I think, you know, that me leaving my body, in a way, it was almost like my subconscious mind needed time to process everything that had happened on a deeper level than I'd ever processed it before. And sometimes when you just like leave something and walk away and don't think about it, epiphanies happen, you know? And then I would make up for a week of not writing because it would all come to me at once. And it's been a powerful exercise in learning how to trust myself and let go. And on the days when I couldn't write, just not writing. Cause it's like, okay, I'm not ready yet. And, but I also had the privilege of not working to a deadline. It's a dubious privilege, right? Because every writer wants their penguin contract, but I did have the luxury of writing on my timeline. And I think that made a big difference.
That's awesome. So I kind of want to go back to the relationship with your spouse. I know a lot of your book does touch on that theme. So are you able to share with us a little bit more about your experience of how complex that was for the both of you after having a child? I feel this, really, I do, because ever since I've had 2 kids with my spouse, it's been hard. It's been so hard in our relationship. So I kind of want to hear from you and where you were at during your writing process with this.
Of course. Well, congrats on having 2. we've got one right now. I consider myself to be my other child and my book, you know. I was like, okay, I have enough on my plate right now. It's tough, you know. Babies, we love our children inexplicably. Or that's the wrong word. All right, let's start this sentence again. We love our children indescribably. Mm-hmm. Like the love is infinite. But the fact of the matter is, babies take everything from you. You know, they don't even smile intentionally until about 6 weeks in, you know? So people the Pampers narrative does such a disservice to new parents, because that initial phase of parenting, you know, at the very least, the initial phase of parenting can be much more dark and chaotic than affirming. Mm-hmm. I felt like my baby hated me. I was like, what is this? Like, it really hates me. And then you're alone with it. So you're stuck. Like your whole world closes in as a mom. It becomes very small. Your world becomes your breasts or a bottle and this being who just hates your fucking guts, you know, at first. And, you know, that's a whirlwind, and all the vulnerabilities in a partnership are exposed at that point, right? Because you're not getting any sleep. You're losing all your nutrients. If you're breastfeeding, and often if you're breastfeeding, your nipples are broken. If you're not breastfeeding, you're up anyway. So it's like, there's really no way to win at first. It's just tough. And, you just have to like put your head down and somehow get through it. And I think most people can relate to that initial period of shock. And in some case, you know, depending on how sensitive you might be at the time, it can feel like trauma, you know, but I think for me and Tom, it was hard after that to get back on our feet. You know, we're a military family, historically at the time Tom was working with the British military. So that meant a lot of moving around in life. For financial reasons, I left the workforce after I had a baby because we couldn't afford for me to work and do childcare. And, you know, I think a lot of women are put in that position. And it's been interesting how that's reared its ugly head during the pandemic as well. And so I lost my social circuit because my students and my colleagues as an educator were my world. And so I was thrust into isolation. That's hard to recover from anyway. And then we immigrated again. So as soon as I had adjusted to being sort of like a stay-at-home mom in a small village in England, which was not an easy adjustment, it was so, you know, there were days I would just push the buggy, you know, the stroller around the same field, like over and over, just sobbing, like in the middle of nowhere near Stonehenge, right? Like, I'm just like, it was trippy, the isolation. But then as soon as I had sort of adjusted, I met a few other moms in the area. Then Tom is like, we're going back to America. Woohoo. And I didn't speak to him for 48 hours because I was just like, you cannot be doing this, because I had been living in England from, well, the age of 21 to my 30s. So my whole, like literally from 3 weeks after graduating from college to my 30s. So my whole experience of the professional world, all of my experiences as an adult, and my whole context for motherhood was British, even though I'm American. So it was a very weird sort of identity split. And then I had to come back here, a place that I did not know how to function. I couldn't drive a car on the right, you know? And so I was disempowered again. But, you know, my husband goes to the supermarket deli, and because he has a British accent, he's getting like free ham. And I'm like the uncute expat who literally can't function in her own culture. So Tom and I, you know, we just couldn't win for a while. And then neither of us really had the relationship with our parents that would have made it possible geographically or otherwise for them to be around helping us. So he and I were kind of on an island. And that island was like the island of broken toys. It was not a fun place. And because we never really recovered, my postpartum depression got worse and worse. And it was also undiagnosed. So, you know, like I couldn't get my footing. Everything kept getting upended. And I couldn't stabilize myself. And because from the outside, we did not appear to be living in squalor, I never got pegged as a mental health problem. I just think that Tom and I got lost in the system. And because I had never had a child before, I didn't know that all of motherhood isn't just miserable. I didn't know I was sick. I thought that was just what it is now. And in that, our marriage deteriorated because we didn't have sort of the wisdom or the support to know that it wasn't our fault. We had to give each other the grace to grow separately on our own timelines. And it was really tough to do. We went to therapy for that, to try to find a way to give each other the chance to go on very separate journeys while still co-parenting and being best friends. It was scary, but I feel really grateful that we were able to reconnect down the road.
Yeah, congratulations. That's really awesome. I love that we're getting to hear this experience, because for some, it might not even like be a possibility or think that that was an option. But I think that that's cool, and that you guys, like you said, you met together down the road in order for y'all to, you know, experience your own growth. So that's really awesome.
Well, thank you. And actually, I'm turning American Rapture into a new media project. And one of the things I talk about in my entertainment piece and in my performance work with this book is the process of trying to be in an open marriage with Tom. Oh my God, I am such a failure to launch. Like, it was really just one disaster after the next, but that was so educational, you know, and we really went out and learned what the world is like for a second. And then we're like, oh, we appreciate each other that much more, you know? So, I mean, it was ugly and it was heinous. I've been stood up at international airports. Like, it's been a journey, but like the fact of the matter is, through it all, friendship persisted and it made it possible for us to find each other again. So I am very grateful for that now.
This topic could be this conversation could be a whole like other topic for an episode, because it's so interesting. In your book, you do mention some of those experiences, right, where you're dating and because I didn't really know the full background, and now that we're talking about it, it makes sense, because there's just some hilarious poems in there that you share where you're like, what is dating, what is sexting, or you know, just like your out loud thoughts, and I was like, wait, what's the behind story? So that's really cool that, you know, we get to have.
And it's funny too, you know, because Tom and I got married in 2009, and the world has changed, and sex has changed, and relationships have changed. Everything has shifted. Oh my God. And here I am like online dating with like my baby screaming on my hip, like being super sincere with people and like taking what they say at face value. And it turns out like literally every human is a predator. And I'm just like, it was a learning curve. Okay. So it was, but that was fascinating unto itself. You know, the world is changing really quickly. We've started almost seeing one another as avatars. And in that respect, you know, that informed my drive to write this book and to create not only a safe space, but an honest space and a loving and a compassionate and a sincere space, because I couldn't find that anywhere else when I got sick.
That's awesome. I want to kind of go back to what we were talking about as well with you're mentioning how through this experience as moms during the pandemic, it's like a whole different form of isolation. And so I kind of want to talk more about that and how, you know, we're also trying to navigate our own mental health and our kids' mental health, and it's overwhelming and it's lonely. How have you been taking care of your mental health and the mental health for your child?
Well, you know, I've been joking to the audience inside my head that my bunker was stocked years ago, man. Like I was so isolated as a young mom. I had to be totally self-sufficient, and I was at the start of the pandemic, I was pretty used to the despair of not seeing other people or feeling like you have a life or accessing the real world. Like I was downright cocky. I was like, oh, y'all missing the world, huh? Welcome. You know, I was suddenly the queen of the darkness. But it's even run its course with me by now. For my son, it's hard because sometimes I feel like I'm feeling him and I know better, but there are days where I just feel so down. And I don't know if you guys are struggling with this too. I mean, I think everyone is right now, right? Like there are days when we feel so down. And as a mother, what you don't really understand until you become a parent is that you're a 24-hour news cycle, because that kid is watching you, and you can't just sort of surreptitiously be depressed. Like, they are learning how to interact with the world from you, from your modeling. And so if you're down that day, that's what you're modeling. And that's petrifying to me, right? Because I don't want to model a defeated attitude for my child. And there are times when we just, we're entitled to feel defeated. Like we're allowed to feel down. So,
but I think, sorry to interrupt you. I think though that is okay and healthy to teach them that, because it's okay to have those emotions. Yes. And it's okay to not be on all the time, to not be positive Patty all the time. And it's okay to feel your feelings. But I feel like, especially for boys, it's okay to be emotional. It's okay to show your emotions. You don't have to be a man all the time. And it's okay to cry. So
yeah. Oh, I'm definitely doing my part to overthrow the toxic masculinity in this house. Yeah. I agree. And I think that's what I was going to say too, is that the way I deal with it is by turning my dark moments or mommy's sad moments into a teachable moment, you know? So when I'm feeling down, and who knows if this is the right thing or the wrong thing, you know, there's no rules. So when I'm feeling down, I sometimes, if it feels right, I pull him aside. I'm like, I'm feeling really down. And then he says, well, why, mommy? And I said, well, because of da, 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 da. And he says, oh, I understand. And then I say, you know, what do you think I should do to feel a little better? And we talk through it. And I think, you know, that it's really important that we teach our kids that the full spectrum of emotions is a gift. Mm-hmm. And we can't have joy without despair. We can't, sometimes anger, for example, is like a direct result of love. You know, all these things, it's a beautiful symphony, and we need to learn to operate in each of those spaces as healthily as we can. I want my son to know that if you're in a dark place, that is not only human, sometimes it's a healthy response to what's happening. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is engage with that so that we can learn healthy ways to inhabit that space.
It is reality. We're not being a pessimist, but this is what we need to talk about. So I think that it's good that you're doing that with your son. And I hope to continue that conversation with my sons instead of just
I empower you to do that. Let's do it. Because, you know, here's the other thing. I have had really insecure moments when I realized my book was being published about one day my son is going to see this. Mm-hmm. And I had to sort of catch myself, because that instinct to seem perfect for him was tripping me up. And what I've had to intellectualize for myself to come to peace with it is that if I raise him right, if I raise him to be an empath, to be compassionate, to understand that life is a journey and we're walking it and we're a team and we never give up, but that does not mean everything is pretty. If I can teach him those things, then one day when he's old enough to read the book, he'll look at it and, you know, my vision is that he'll think I'm a badass, you know? Yeah. Like so that's how I've restructured it for myself. Like I've kind of flipped the script inside my head. Like, this is not the narrative of a woman who has failed. This is the story of a woman who's a warrior. Mm-hmm. And I want him to look at it one day and think, wow, you know, my mom is my hero. That's my dream.
On that note, for the sake of time, I mean, I feel like Celeste and I could talk to you all day, and we may even need a part two if you're down with that, to discuss.
So down.
All right, cool. To discuss even beyond just your book, but to have these other conversations that Celeste had mentioned, you know, this could be a conversation for a whole nother episode. But before we go, I want people to know how they can find you and engage with you, and definitely how they can pick up your book, because this, every woman needs to read it. I mean, men too, but really women need to read this. So tell us.
Of course. So www.americanrapture.com is sort of a hub for everything that's going on with the book. But I am at JC McCraw, JCMCCRAW on Instagram, and I am keeping the journey sort of cataloged on there. The book is available everywhere that books are sold globally, and you know, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, all those places. But if possible, I prefer people to go to bookshop.org and give business to independent booksellers, many of whom have been struggling in this pandemic because we all need to look after our people. And the audiobook produced by me is on Audible. And there is a, I mentioned it briefly earlier, a new media project of American Rapture that's being produced out of Los Angeles. All of that is something for people to keep an eye out for. And if they want to have a look on Instagram, maybe a follow of my page, I'm going to be updating the journey as it evolves, because my goal is to take American Rapture into the theatrical domain, particularly post-COVID, to take theater back into people's homes through the performance of my work. And that journey is really just sort of starting to take off.
Thank you so much, Jordan. We truly have enjoyed having you and sharing your raw and just pretty intimate moments with us. It was awesome. I'm sure that this episode is going to resonate with a lot of women. And thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I hope we can connect again sometime.